Good afternoon. It's 1 o'clock, and we will begin our Health Sciences Committee meeting. Winter, could you please take roll?
Chair Goodman?
Here.
Vice Chair Del Carlo?
Here.
Regent Brager?
Here.
Regent Perkins?
Here.
You do have a quorum present.
Thank you. All right. Good afternoon. I'd like for Regent Brager to please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Thank you. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
If I'm leading, I'm leading.
Thank you, Regent Brager. I'd like to now read the land acknowledgement. Before beginning, we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, Washo, the Numu, Northern Paiute, the Nuwe, Western Shoshone, and the Nuwu, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign tribal nations of Nevada. Now moving to item one, public comment. For those of you who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171. Enter the meeting ID of 928-4944-5069 and passcode 555-555. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There's none at this time.
Thank you very much. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
None at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas? Looks like none. And SCS, is anyone on the phone? Thank you. All right, moving forward, the committee will consider approval of the minutes from the September 5th, 2024 meeting. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Thank you.
I'll make the second.
Thank you. A motion by Regent Brager and a second by Regent Del Carlo. All those in favor? State aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you. All right, moving to number three, Chair's report. Basically, what we're doing is we've increased our meetings to four meetings now a year, so that's giving us a little bit more time to devote to talking about what we're doing in this health science space that's so vitally important. I believe that we really need to continue to improve in this space. We're doing great things, but I think we can even do better for our state. And I'm very excited that we have some of the agenda items on here today that are putting us in a space where we are more of a system, alleviating some of those hurdles that students have to go through if they want to transfer. We're starting the pathway here to move the needle and to really try to affect some positive change here in the system. Additionally, I'm grateful for our presentations today on the budget, which also is a movement towards more transparency here in this space. As regents, we all are very excited to see more transparent budget reports and have those budget reports available for the public. This is a great move today for us to be doing this. So I will not carry on, but I feel like we are moving the needle in the right direction. I am grateful for everyone's hard work today, and thank you. Moving on, we have the NSHE Health Sciences update. Associate Vice Chancellor for Health Sciences, Marcia Turner, will provide an overview of the history and current focus of the system's health sciences operations. Additionally, Dr. Turner will share an update on NSHE's plan for overseeing health science-related matters throughout the upcoming Nevada legislative session. I am very excited to hear from you, Marcia. Go for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Dr. Marcia Turner, I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Health Sciences. And it is a pleasure to be here with you, and it's so exciting to see what is happening with the Health Sciences Committee, because I think it's a very important committee, and I appreciate all of your time in this, and I appreciate the deans and everyone who's presenting today, because I think it's all really important stuff, so thank you. So my goal today is to try and keep it short and sweet because you have a very full agenda. But I want to try and give you a little bit of background on my professional experience and kind of put in context the work that I've done in Nevada over the last 30 years related to this stuff. Give you a quick overview of the past and the present of the focus of health sciences from the system office standpoint, and I invite Chancellor Charlton to jump in on anything related to that too, so to make sure I get the focus clear. And then also just give you an update on what we're our game plan for the legislative session. So really quickly, so I moved here 30 years ago to work for Pat Mulray in the County Water Authority, working on a big water treatment plant project. I worked on the creation of the Las Vegas Springs Preserve. So I began working with the county and all the local municipalities on that water project, which was a great way to learn the town. And from there, I did a short stint at the city of Las Vegas working with Regent Goodman as she was the mayor's right hand. I was the chief administrative officer for the city. And then my friends at the county tapped me to come back to the county, but this time to work at UMC. And that was the beginning of my healthcare career, and it was just a blessing. It was such a neat opportunity. So I served as the administrator for intergovernmental relations for UMC for 4 years. And then from there, I got tapped by UNLV to come be their director of government relations for 2 years. And that's where I learned the academic side. I worked with the nursing department, the dental school, all the allied health programs at UNLV. And that's when Jim Rogers became chancellor. And one of his initiatives was looking at the whole system and looking at efficiency and effectiveness measures, and he focused on the health sciences programs and recognized the fact that there are a lot of programs, there's a lot of students, a lot of faculty, and a lot of money because they're in large part very expensive programs, all operating throughout the system. And this was 20 years ago, and things were a little different. The culture was different. It was right before the recession. Funds were even shorter than they are now, and so he created a committee to look at what could we do to help build bridges and increase the collaboration among the different programs. And so Carol Harder tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, you just worked at a hospital, go sit on that committee. Famous last words, I ended up going to work for Jim to help with the creation of the Health Sciences Division back in 2006. I was there for about 10 years and worked on a variety of different things with all the different health science programs. The last big thing we worked on was the expansion of the public medical education, which resulted in the expansion of UNR up in the north and their partnership with Renown and the creation of the UNLV School of Medicine. And as a result of all of that work and the UNLV School of Medicine, the county land transfer, we were doing a lot of work with UMC. And Mason Van Helling recruited me to become the chief administrative officer at UMC to help with the transition of the med schools and also to oversee all the academic affairs, the Office of Clinical Trials. And so I had a wonderful time coming back to UMC. So I spent about 20 years between UMC and NSHE. And throughout that whole time, I lobbied for both entities throughout the legislative sessions in those 20 years. And then I had an opportunity to jump out of the private sector into the public sector to work as a chief operating officer for a private biotech company and learned a lot about research and tech transfer and IP and all that kind of stuff. And then I had the opportunity to come back to the system. So that's a little background of my experience and a lot of the relationships and the experience I've had in working with the government agencies and working with the county is all something that's very, very handy right now. So when we look at the past and the current focus for health sciences, as I mentioned, there was sort of a broader approach to health sciences back, 20 years ago and up to 2016. The focus now is a little bit more targeted. And again, Patty, jump in if you want to amplify any of this. But the idea overall has been, how can we at the system level help optimize the programs? We're not involved in the teaching or the specific running of the programs, but what can we do at the system level to help you all as regents in your interaction with the programs, but also to help with the schools, to help the individual programs, to help them do whatever extra mile thing they want to get done. So specifically, there's some stuff going on with the medical schools, some opportunities for some special initiatives with the partnerships, the different affiliation down here, the relationship with UMC, relationship with NHBC, there's a lot that's being done with partnerships with the Department of Health and Human Services and Medicaid. So there's a lot with the medical schools that we can do to support them. But we're also interacting with dental and nursing and public health because there's some opportunities and challenges that are popping up that we at the system level can do to help with affiliations and so on. So, and one of the things that Patty's asked me to focus on is during this legislative session to help bird dog the health sciences related legislation. Because if you look at the gazillion bills that affect ENCHI in one way or another, there's a subset of those bills that have to do with the health education programs. But as you will hear today, one thing that's different, especially with the medical schools, is we're not just an academic unit. They're actually a clinical unit providing care, and they're a business. So whether it's insurance changes or reimbursements from Medicaid, licensure, there's so many different bills that touch the health sciences units that's a little bit different than the traditional academic programs. So I have already been meeting with Alejandro, and there's a lot that we'll be doing with Michael Flores and Constance Brooks because the medical schools are going to have a lot of this, but it's nursing, public health. The other programs will have legislation that comes through. So step one is be well coordinated with all of the different representatives and the system and my friends up here because there's just, you know, we need to stay coordinated. We need to communicate. We need to make sure that there are no surprises and that everybody is in the loop as needed going forward. The other thing that I've started to do is I meet with the medical school deans pretty regularly, but I've also been reaching out to meet with the dean of dental, the nursing deans, public health. Some of them are old-timers that I know from my prior roles, but some of them are new faces too. So, and the reason why I'm connecting with them is because they are the subject matter experts. So when a bill comes through, I can look at it, but I might miss something. And so and even with nursing, an ADN nursing dean may look at it different than a graduate level program. So we need to have careful and, you know, inclusive consultation with the subject matter experts. And then develop our positions and then work through, especially with the legislative folks, to make sure that we're being very deliberate in our briefing or lobbying and conveying our position. Whether we're educating or advocating, we need to have a coordinated message. And so that's the goal. And it's easier in the beginning of the session than as the session drones on and there's tons of bills to process. But we will do our best, and we will do our best to keep you all in the loop, too. So with that, go ahead.
Go ahead, Chancellor.
All right. Good afternoon. For the record, Patty Charlton, Chancellor, Nevada System of Higher Education. So first, I just really want to thank you all for this opportunity to have Associate Vice Chancellor Marcia Turner present to you today. So one of the things that I know, and we all know if you've been a long-term resident of Nevada, is that there's nothing more important than education and healthcare. And our needs are very deep in our state. We have amazing medical schools. And so what we really want to do is to ensure that we have a focused effort, focused attention on our healthcare needs so that we can be the supporter of our state that they need. And so one of the things that in my short time here at the system office is there's not a room that I don't walk into that we don't hear the priority is about healthcare. It's about the need to shore up our medical schools, to give them the resources to help them to expand capacity, but also to retain our medical providers once they are trained here, and then to also ensure that we are providing the community that the quality health care that they need and that they deserve. And so to have a voice that can help to be another lever for the support of the institutions, but also to keep this board informed and up to date is most important. So we want to be concerted, we want to be focused, and we want to be collaborative. So thank you.
Buttons, I'm telling you. Thank you, Chancellor. And I couldn't agree more. I think it's vital that we do our best for our state. So it's kind of what I said in my remarks earlier. So I would love, first of all, Marcia, I've always thought you were a rock star. So thank you for being a part of the team. And I think Is there anything specific, like with all these bills that are coming down, are there a few highlighted bills that you feel like we really need to pay attention to that could adversely affect what we're trying to do, or bills that could really make a difference for us? If you have any insight, if I'm putting you on the spot, we can talk about it later too. That's fine.
Well, it's a little early in the process. There are some pre-filed bills, but not a lot of them. We have some intel that there might be some others coming, but they're in draft form, and it's really kind of too early in the process
even with BDRs.
Yeah, okay. And so what we do anticipate is that the governor will have some sort of a package of something that will be included in his State of the State address, which will be the official time that that's available, and a final version of whatever that ends up looking like. We do anticipate that there, thinking ahead, there will probably be something related to the funding of GME programs. And so what form that takes and where it comes through, we definitely have that on our radar. There will probably be other things related to nursing. There's sort of the traditional things that come up. So the short answer is it's just a little early in the process. But we will monitor it and do our best to keep you in the loop as things come, especially to highlight the priority bills that are really going to make a difference. There's a lot of bills that we just need to monitor, but the ones that I think from a system level that you'd be interested in, we'll be sure to keep you in the loop.
And are you coordinating this entire effort?
I will be bird dogging the health sciences piece, but...
Yes, for the record, Patty Charlton. So when it comes to legislation, Alejandro Rodriguez, our Director of Government Affairs, will be navigating that vast array of bills, and then we'll have our subject matter experts. Obviously, the deans are going to be critical, and then Marcia as well, so as it pertains to health sciences.
And I have one more question, then I'll move to Regent Brager. But, okay, great. I guess my question, too, is are we able to make sure that I think it's vital that even as regents that we coordinate through you. I would just recommend that we try to create an effort like that so that if we are up there, if we are talking, it is, as you said, coordinated, and we are working through you as you and Alejandro as the two herders of cats, I would think, probably. So, yes.
So, Chair Goodman, just for the record again, Patty Charlton. So, obviously, we have the board has some very defined policies as it pertains to that coordinated effort, and I really want to appreciate the Regents' conversations at the December meeting earlier this month. As we have to take positions on bills, and then as we move forward, I'll be taking the lead in consultation with the board chair and with all of the teams. But yes, but Marcia will definitely be the lead as it pertains to health sciences with
me. Thank you. Go ahead, Regent Brager.
Thank you. Susan Brager for the record. So can we make sure when we're getting reports, I would like to see, this is just me, and hopefully everybody, if it has to be an item, I'll ask for it in new business, medical separated from everything else. It can become very overwhelming, and I'm not usually overwhelmed, but I do serve on an organization where we follow certain bills, but we do it in a manner that it makes it very readable, and so I'm hoping it's not just blasted out, that there's a way, high priority would be very important, and I know that in the December meeting, it is important for all board members to not just go, I'm going to just say it because I've been there through county commission, and I get it, just go off on their own, because it will make, and I'm just going to say it verbally, makes the legislators very unhappy. And I don't know why they're like that, but they are. And it's an honest fact, so hopefully they can appreciate that. But I think we need to make sure that it's a concerted effort together. And if someone's going to go speak, that it's through our lobbyists. But I would say, I'm hoping that the new building, like the Sawyer building was, that if we needed to go speak and we didn't want to spend the money going up there, that we could go to that building. I've spoke before for Southern Hills Hospital, being on their board. So I know what it, and I'm sure everybody here knows what it takes and how you have to do it. You can be on phone holding till 2 and 3 in the morning, I will tell you that, because it's pretty amazing how that works. It's unfortunate. So that's just some of the things that I feel we need to be very practiced about and very, it's just very important.
For the record, Marcia Turner, thank you, Regent Brager. I think that's a great idea. And the other thing, too, to keep in mind is even if we send out a briefing the night before, that morning something might have changed. So even if you're going to go testify, it's always good to touch base. But thank you.
And just to follow up, just one more quick thing. And just to follow up on that, I think having that knowledge of what it is we're speaking about, I would like to see that chancellor or yourself would be the one that would ask, hey, can you go to the, I want to keep calling it the Sawyer building, but right now it's the Harris building. So it's kind of interesting. It's where we have our workforce development meetings, though. I think it'd be good that we had the paper on it, that we spoke as one. And I just find that to work so much better.
Thank you, Regent Brager. Go ahead, Regent Del Carlo.
We need a new system.
Right. Thank you, Chair Goodman. This is the first time since I've been on the board we've had this position. So thank you that I know of in the last 8 years, right, Patty? Chancellor?
So in the last 8 years, we previously had a vice chancellor for health sciences, and then just with some of the transitions, but yes, I thought it was important and it was a priority to bring it back.
Well, I thank you for that because I think there's a huge need, especially coordination. I mean, this is a big bulk of what we do to educate and everything else. But a question, this came up in public comment, I think, at maybe the December meeting, but I was wondering, are you going to get involved? We heard from I think it was the faculty that said they're going to lose their HMO plan. The state was, is that part of what you're going to be doing and lobbying and helping? Because I feel like we should help our faculty too.
So for the record, Patty Charlton, Chair Goodman, through you.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to do all that stuff.
All right. Regent Del Carlo. So yes, yeah, so I did want to just let you know that I'm working with Chris Vitone, Michelle Kelly, and also our HR office as it pertains to the HMO. That's actually a benefit plan under the state, so we're working on that a little bit separately, but I know that Marcia seems to know everybody, so Dr. Turner does. But I will say that one of the other things that you heard in public comment was related to some concerns from student groups that are struggling with finding clinical opportunities.
Yes.
In cardiorespiratory therapy. So yes, I will tell you those things Dr. Turner is working on.
Okay,
well,
I'm glad to hear that because benefits affect us in our recruitment and our retention of great qualified employees. So that's real important to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo. And we want to take care of our current faculty and employees as well.
Retention.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Turner. I appreciate your information today, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Moving forward, we will go to item number, item number 5, NC Schools of Medicine Budgets. Dean of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Kirk Kerkorian School of Medicine, Dr. Mark J. Kahn, and Dean of the University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine, Dr. Paul J. Hauptmann, will provide reports on their respective medical school budgets, including organizational structures, funding by source, expenditures, income, and financial status. I'm very excited to hear you both. Shall we start with Dr. Hauptmann? Hello, sir. It's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could have the slides up, please. So, Chair Goodman and committee members, for the record, Paul Hauptmann, Dean at the University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine. I'm delighted to present, as requested, a report on our budget. Any such discussion is aided by outlining how a medical school exists in the healthcare ecosystem.
We're almost there. We're trying to get the right slides up.
Unless you want to give my talk.
I believe it's HSS5B. Thanks. No pressure.
Good, we have the right colors up there too.
Oh boy, hey, I wore red today just for you, Dr. Hauptmann.
So this is a simplified model of the organizational structure of medical schools in the U.S. The three components of the medical school infrastructure include the medical school itself, a practice plan where teaching physicians see patients, and a teaching hospital or academic medical center. The relationships between these entities are diverse and often unique to each academic health system. However, the relationships between the component parts will dictate how funds flow works between the entities, especially the ownership and control of the practice plan, which can be under the medical school or under the teaching hospital or increasingly under an overarching health system. At UNR, we have experienced a significant change in the ownership structure of the practice plan. In recent history, in 2017, the Southern Practice Plan was divested to UNLV Health, and in 2021, the Northern Practice Plan was divested to Renown Health. Our current structure is a practice plan owned by Renown, the academic health system. It's important to highlight this structural difference because it explains some of the differences in funds flow between UNR and UNLV, which owns its own practice plan, and you'll hear more about that from my colleague, Dean Kahn, shortly. In fiscal year 24, the total revenue for the medical school was $158 million compared to expenses of $152 million. As you can see, while state appropriations, tuition, and associated revenues represent a significant amount of revenue, the school also derives revenue from other sources that support graduate medical education, clinical care, research, and other self-supporting activities, which I will explain throughout this presentation. This chart shows you a more detailed view of our sources of revenue. Our base state appropriation is $54.7 million, and tuition is $7.36 million, representing 40% of our budget. A further $45.8 million is derived from our research activities and facilities and administration, or F&A, representing 29% of total budget, while a further 31% is derived from various self-supporting activities, including graduate medical education and clinical contracts with Renown Health. Comparative data from the AAMC compares government and parent support across medical schools. In 2023, UNR reported $37.9 million in state-appropriated support, which is below both the national and Western regional averages for public medical schools. It is worth noting that state appropriations may support more than just medical school operations and are variable across states. However, it is a useful comparison to see how our state support compares to other public medical schools. Let me go back. This table adds some more context on how we allocate state funding based on the programming that it supports. A significant portion of our state funding goes to support teaching and service of our clinical and basic science faculty, totaling $14 million. We spent $1.7 million on funds that have been allocated to support specific service centers, including the Office of Statewide Initiatives and Rural Health. $9.3 million is spent on the infrastructure to support the MD program, including leadership roles, support staff, and educational resources. A small allocation is made to support the central infrastructure of our graduate medical education programs. $4.1 million is allocated as operations and maintenance transfer to the university to support the facility's infrastructure. $16 million is allocated to support the central administration of the school, including school leadership, information systems, administrative functions such as legal, human resources, and finance, the medical library, and the office of faculty. $11.7 million was transferred to Medicaid to support the medical supplemental programs. In addition, the school manages the state allocation for the state public health lab and the Nevada Health Service Corps program. Finally, we have a budget allocation from the university to support the undergraduate program for speech pathology and audiology. This graphic gives you a flavor of the complexity of funding for our academic faculty. I want to make sure we're on the right slide. One back. Thank you. Faculty effort related to teaching in the MD program and school leadership roles is derived from the state. However, we also derive significant support from research grants and self-supporting activities, primarily clinical contracts with Renown. In medicine, faculty are expected to provide clinical care and conduct research, and all medical schools will have funding structures for core teaching faculty that look similar. This is because we expect our students to be taught by experts in the field and be taught in active laboratory and clinical environments. This structure is, however, complicated by ever-changing funds flow from grants and clinical effort that makes managing faculty effort and funding complex. UNR is currently working with a state Medicaid office to leverage state dollars to support supplemental programs that provide federal matching dollars to bring new revenue to the state. It must be clearly stated and understood that federal law prohibits reimbursement to UNR for the intergovernmental transfer sent to Medicaid, and we provide it, the IGT, toward GME and our provider-based program. Our affiliate as a teaching hospital is able to increase Medicaid access for the Northern Nevada community and receive funding to help defray increased costs of training students and residents. We are expanding the provider-based program and are exploring a new Medicaid academic partnership for faculty recruits that consult with Medicaid. Finally, a new indirect medical education program, which is currently under negotiation, will provide financial support to expand our teaching faculty and graduate medical education programming. This is a summary of how the funds flow works for these programs. The state agency here, UNR Med, provides the state share as an intergovernmental transfer to Medicaid. Medicaid uses that share to draw down a federal match of up to 3 times the state share. The combined funds are then dispersed to teaching hospitals. For the provider programs, this is based on claims data, namely the number of Medicaid patients seen, which makes these more challenging to predict. The relationships between Renown and UNR for the provision of academic support are complicated and growing. The total funds flow from Renown to UNR in fiscal year 24 is $36.3 million for various programs. UNR clinical faculty provide clinical services, Renown leases some UNR space, and Renown support for UNR leadership roles total $9.6 million. Renown supports $9.8 million for residents and fellows and graduate medical education infrastructure. $1 million supports an academic office at Renown Health, which enables us to embed an academic infrastructure into the Renown organization. $2.9 million is provided to the dean to support the academic mission. $10.9 million is provided in academic support for our core infrastructure and teaching activities that would otherwise be supported by other sources. $350,000 is given directly to the university to support MD and PA student scholarships. $1.7 million supports the Healthy Nevada Project, a genomics research initiative. These relationships are underpinned by a legal structure of several affiliation agreements and many individual contracts. On my last slide, I would like to highlight that our graduate medical education programs are not entirely funded by Renown Health. UNR bills other healthcare providers for the service provided by its residents and fellows, including the VA and several community providers. We are currently working on additional funding through the state legislature and grant-making agencies to find new sources of funding to support desperately needed graduate medical education expansion. Our teams have been working with our renowned colleagues to plan for program expansion. Our long-term plan, funding permitted, is to nearly double the size of our programs to help address critical physician workforce shortages. Finally, I wanted to thank the chair and members of the committee for this opportunity to provide a snapshot of our finances. Running a medical school is financially complex because of our tripartite mission to educate, provide clinical care, and conduct research, and the multi-tiered relationships with external stakeholders. From the outside looking in, this can resemble a labyrinth, but we welcome you to come and visit the campus and see the great work that our faculty and staff are doing to advance medicine. I'm also happy to answer any questions, and we'll ask Philip Clark, who's the Senior Associate Dean for Administration and Finance at UNR Med, to join me at the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hotman. I'll open it up for questions. Regent Brager.
This is more possibly to Dr. Turner. So we're global and non-territorial as regents, or we should be. We have the medical school up in the other part of our state and the medical school in this part of the state. I see us as a statewide system. So my question really is, when we're going to the legislature, we don't want to pit one campus against the other campus or one medical school against the other medical school. How are we going to make sure that needs are met and we're not doing something like that? That's not probably for you, but you're welcome. I mean, if that is, I'm more than happy to have you answer. So it's more global than it is individually each campus, because I think that could be a bad thing to do.
So for the record, Patty Charlton, and so Regent Brager, one thing I really want to give kudos to both Dean Hopman and Dean Kahn is their collaboration and their partnership. And so in many of our conversations as we're building up to the legislative session is they are joined at the hip together. They have joint priorities that this board has set. And so that is really important. So as we advocate to the legislature, it is based on the board's priorities for the system and in which they've also supported the institution. So we work very closely together, and I really appreciate the work that they do together. And so we'll be all focused on those joint priorities so that we don't have one institution or one school pitted against the other.
Okay, and I will let you speak. I feel like it's really important because, let's say through my county commission days, it was not always like that. So I love that the unity is there because we can't do that. We can't go with different messages to our legislators. And each school is unique, and each school serves a very wide population and needs throughout the state. So I really like hearing that that has come together, and that I hope that we continue doing it that way. But please, I'm happy to, through the chair, hear what you have to say.
Regent Brager, Paul Hauptmann, for the record. In the last biennium, Dean Kahn and I went together and testified together at the state legislature. About 6 months ago, we met together with the governor to talk about the GME budget. This morning, we had a mini retreat. We have two initiatives that we're working together on. One is to stand up a center for patient safety and simulation, which would be a statewide effort. Mm-hmm. And the second, targeting 2026 or 2027, is to establish a Nevada State Medical Journal. And we will be the co-editors of that journal. So we continue to work together very closely.
I am so excited to hear that. And it's time for that to happen because we are a small state. And I'm so tired of hearing North and South as I continue to call it a statewide venture. And the more we do that, I think the better and more cohesive we will be as not only a board, but as a society. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Regent Del Carlo? Okay. What happens if this pending VA hospital comes up there? How is all of that going to work together? It's very exciting, of course, but how does that fit into all of this with you and Renown? And
thanks, Chair Goodman. For the record, Paul Hauptmann, Dean at UNR Med. We're very hopeful that we will get the green light and that the new VA hospital will be built on the northern end of the UNR campus. We think it's additive to our mission. And will benefit not just the medical school, but the Orvis School of Nursing, the School of Public Health, the School of Social Work, to have geographical co-location, basically, with the VA hospital. It's also my hope that the architectural plans will include some new wet lab space, which opens up the possibility of joint appointments of basic scientists in the VA and at UNR Med.
Very exciting. Thank you so much for your presentation. Go ahead. Sorry, Regent Brager.
I love medical. So since we have a VA hospital here, I've not heard anything about any joint ventures there. Is that something you'll speak about when you come up? Thank you.
Okay. Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you. And I've seen you guys working together well, the two deans. And I think it's wonderful because I hadn't seen that before since I've been on the board. And we accomplish so much more when we work together. I mean, healthcare is important to every Nevadan, no matter where they live. So I really applaud that. So I just have a question. I know when the school split off, when UNLV came online, the practice plan stayed, their practice plan stayed down here, but then the practice plans with Renown. So Renown has its own board, and that board doesn't report to us as regents or any of that. So how do we know when I mean, we don't see any of those figures as regents. So it's pretty hard for us to do a fiduciary, which is our main responsibility. So is that something that would bring up a new business? I mean, that we would have better reporting down the road so we know your practice plan is spot on and healthy and all that? Or you know what I'm trying to ask?
I know what you're trying to ask. I think maybe what we can do is an offline briefing, and then we can kind of determine what Renown is willing to do for the board, and we could maybe come to a conclusion at that point. Would
okay.
that sound good?
That's all within the realm. I mean, because UNLV's is different. That is part of theirs, and we see it, but we don't see yours. So I just think as a regent, we're responsible for everything, so we might as well see something.
Yeah, for the record, Paul Hauptman, Dean at UNR Med, I think that may come down to a regulatory or legal issue about what can and can be shared. Though it is there's plenty of public disclosure from Renown as well in their annual reports.
Well, maybe even the regents get their annual report once a year. It comes through the Health and Science Committee. I'm just asking the questions so we have our arms around all of it.
I made a note, and we'll find a solution for you,
okay.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you
so much. Thank you, Dean Hauptman. Hi, Dean Kahn. Thank you for
Good
being with
afternoon,
us today.
Madam Chair, Chancellor, guests, friends, others. For the record, Mark Kahn, Vice President for Health Affairs at UNLV and Dean of the Kirk Kerkorian School of Medicine. And even though I have an MBA, I've asked my colleague, Ron Bates, to do some of the financial presentations. But if I could have my first slide, please. While we're getting that, let me just also thank my friend Paul Hauptman. We've been really having a good time together over the past couple of years, really working together to improve healthcare for the state. And we realize this is a big state. We're 400 miles apart. We're stronger together. I think what's good for him benefits us, and I'm sure he thinks vice versa. And we're here really to improve care for the entire state. That's why we're here. So I know Dr. Hauptman had a similar slide, but when and I'm going to steal a line he uses sometimes from Kevin Grigsby from the AAMC, who says, if you've seen one medical school, you've seen one medical school. And that's really true, because we all work a little differently. Even though we have the common mission to care for patients, to educate the next generation of care providers, and to do research, and then to also engage with the community, the setups can be vastly different. So we're more traditional in many senses. So we have a medical school, a new one, but we have a medical school. And we have a practice plan that is run by us. Ms. Joanne Strobe and Dr. Allison Netsky are responsible for that. Joanne Strobe is the president and CEO of the practice plan, and Dr. Allison Netsky is our Vice Dean for Clinical Affairs, and we all work together, but the practice plan is the clinical part of what we do. And as with nearly every medical school in the United States that has a practice plan, for better or worse, it's the economic engine so we can hire the physicians we need to provide the care we need to provide. And then finally, we don't own our own hospital. Some medical schools do, but we're closely affiliated with UMC as our primary teaching hospital. But we also have relationships with Sunrise, part of the HCA system, with the VA hospital. So a number of our students train at the VA. A number of our residents work at the VA, and they are clinical faculty, community faculty with us at UNLV. And then we also use a variety of other clinical sites really almost throughout the state, including a rural program in Winnemucca. So there's different ways to do this. There's different ways that these entities overlap, and that will be different ways that there's fund flow. And this talk today, we're going to hopefully elucidate some of those. So when you look at our organizational structure, again, we're a medical school. We right now have 252 undergraduate students. In the medical world, undergraduate means medical school and graduate means residency and fellowship. So let's not confuse that with college undergrads. But we have 252 medical students. They do hospital rotations, again, at UMC, at the VA, at Sunrise, et cetera. We have 342 residents and fellows. Fellows are programs that occur after the primary residency program. So, and then we have 204 of those residents and fellows are funded through UMC. We have we have 187 clinical and academic faculty budgeted in fiscal year 2025. Now, our practice plan is a separate 501c3 nonprofit under UNLV. It's separately audited, but we use the same auditors as the system, and we'll show our most recent audited statements. But let me show off a little bit and jump ahead. We had a clean audit with no material weaknesses, and we made about a 4-5% margin. So we're very happy about that. UMC is our predominant teaching hospital. We have, again, faculty that work there and generate revenue there. We also operate 17 health clinics. We do both GME as well as UME there. We do a number of clinical trials at UMC, and we have professional service agreements with UMC basically for call coverage. So we cover services such as ENT and other services that are needed for patients seen at UMC. Our relationship between the public medical school, UNLV, and our, I don't know if we need to respond to that, but and UMC, our principal partner, is absolutely sacrosanct. Both of us work together to see everybody. Neither of us turn away patients. Both of us do a large amount of free care. For us, it's about $7 million a year. And for us, that's really our mission, to care for this community. So I think I'm going to turn things over to Mr. Bates. Is that right? This is your first slide? Yes, and I'll be here too, and if there are, if I need to add something, I will. But Mr. Bates, why don't you talk about our funding sources as an entity and thereafter. That's forward, that's back.
If I may ask you to just hold 1 minute, they are having some technical difficulties, beeping we're hearing. So if you wouldn't mind, we will just take a 5 minute recess right now, and we'll be back in 5 minutes.
Saved by the bell.
Thank you. Okay, so we're back. I do want to confirm, Regent Perkins, are you able to hear us on the line? Regent Perkins?
Yes, I'm able to hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. All right, we will continue on, Dean Kahn. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chancellor, Regents, guests. Let me introduce my colleague, Mr. Ron Bates, who's our Associate Dean for Administration, and he's going to do most of the financial slides, and I may jump in, but I think he's certainly better prepared to do this. Mr. Bates.
Thank you, Chair Goodman. Thank you, committee members and regents, for allowing us to tell our story. My name is Ron Bates. I'm the Associate Dean of Finance and Facilities for the Kirkacorian School of Medicine and the CFO for UNLV Health. So I think where we are is at the page four on the funding source. And so what I wanted to talk about is, yes, ma'am.
Because we don't have the camera, people that are listening online, if you would just refer to item 5 on the Health Sciences System Committee agenda for the Board of Regents, and it's reference HSS-5A, just so people listening online can have something to refer to. Thank you so much, and go ahead.
Yes. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the funding source, and it's very similar to the slide that Reno shared. You can see for us, we have the dollar amounts on the right and in color. And so you can see the blue is the state appropriations, which includes the student tuition and fees. And that makes up about 25% of our overall funding that comes through at the university. or self-supporting funds, which are those slides in kind of boxed in the graph there, is 30%. And that comes from student fees, program fees that they're charged, clinical contracts, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute and in later slides, and our graduate medical education dollars that flow through the university, and then some research. And then we have some smaller amounts of grants, gifts, and some other fees. The big bar on the right is the UNLV health revenue. So some of that is double counted, and I'll explain that in a little bit. But the UNLV recognizes all the expense and generates all the revenue for their clinical activities. Some of that expense that they incur for the faculty salaries comes back to the university. And so that's what's captured in that, in the some of the practice plan funding that's in that bucket there. So at my last slide about the faculty and how we fund the faculty, we'll give a lot more explanation on that component of it. But I wanted to make sure that you understood that $83 million, and some of that is a little bit counted differently because of the way we do books. And that's handled in our audit at the NC audit. They back out the due from the different entities. So don't want to bore you with too much audit conversation. This is our income statement summary. So you can see that the state provided us in FY24 with $51 million. We actually, for the first time, had a carry forward because of some of our harder to handle or harder to recruit vacancy savings that we had, and there was an ability for us to carry that forward. And so that's why our state funds, we were funded at $51 million, and we only spent $48 million of that. The self-supporting fees and charges shows a negative. It means that we spent more than we received, and the majority of that is due to our GME process and how we pay for residents. So our residents are paid by the university, and then we bill the hospital where they worked, and that takes a little time. So at the end of the year, you see this every year on our quarterly report, we have a balance and an AR balance where we have receivables due, and that's what that's showing because this is a cash basis. And then so our total campus accounts there at that 2.27 is the net of that activity. And then our UNLV health practice plan that Dr. Kahn mentioned, we had $83 million of revenue and had a $3.8 million profit, which was really strong, and we had a very good year. This is a little bit more detail about how we spend our state dollars, whether it's in personnel or through operations. And in our clinical department, which is where our clinical faculty work and have students rotate with them and educate them specifically in their third and fourth years, but throughout their education, they are going to work with our faculty there, as well as we have our residency programs running through our clinical departments. Our MD program support is the personnel that's in our academic affairs and they're working with the students in their curriculum development and all of the activities that go through all 4 years of school. Our GME program support, that from the state side is really the administrative support that goes into running the GME program. So that's where our DIO and her staff are funded, and they have some operational support there as well. Our library, which is really nice to have the library in our medical education building, that's what our funding there. We have a lot of people, but also a lot of subscriptions and electronic records there, and that's where the majority of our operational expenses spent on the library. And then you can see our research is not. A big tax on our state dollars, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the future as well. And then our operation and administration overhead. So we have $8 million, just shy of $8 million in personnel expense, and we have $6 million in operating. A lot of that is due to the lease space that we incur for where our faculty offices are, as well as our administrative offices outside of that medical education building. This biennium, we were able to get support from the state and the Medical Enhancement Fund. which really made up of the ability for us to, three components. We would have additional faculty support. We also have support for our medical education building that was built by a donor and is not a state-owned building, but we operate in there, but we maintain it. And so that's very expensive for us to maintain, and we were given support to do that, as well as to develop the academic health center. So to date, we've spent $3 million, and that's really split, as you can see, between personnel expense and operating expense. So, when I talk to my peers, the state support that we get is really strong, and I think that shows the value that is placed by our community and by NSHE and our legislature on how important it is to improve the medical education here. And so I think this is a good story about how we're using those funds. And here's a little bit more detail about how our money is spent. And you can see that our administration and research, the majority of our expenditures are through the school, and academic funding is with the clinical faculty. And what's interesting is you can see the state support, which is really specific to the academic needs of the medical school and the students, is that blue component, and the orange component is where the faculty earn their salary, and also the additional support for that they have through the UNLV Health Practice Plan. And then our GME program, the majority of those funds outside of the state dollars that we talked about earlier comes from our hospital partners throughout the community. And then you can see our MD program again. So just a different way to look at, but not just the state, but kind of our all source funding for our faculty. The support that we get from UMC, and Dr. Khan talked about our relationship with UMC, is summarized here. The PSAs are professional service agreements that we have to provide medical services to the hospital and to the community, and also gives us an opportunity to train our students and residents in an environment where they're practicing these services. As you can see, it's broken out here through our medicine, psychiatry, OBGYN, our surgical services, and pediatric services. So that makes up just shy of $13 million in contracts that we work with UMC to provide. The GME support that we get from them, as Dr. Khan mentioned in the first slide, is 204 residents and fellows rotate through UMC locations, and they provide the financial support for those residents. And that's about $16.2 million. In addition to that, we have a clause that they provide us mission support that allows us to provide operational support or other support in alignment with that mission for our residency program. And you can see it for the purpose of joint efforts in the areas of teaching, research, and or community service. So that's been extremely helpful to us to do sometimes things that we really didn't plan on in the budget season, we didn't have funds for, and that was able to help support and grow those things that align with both of our missions. This is just a little bit of a historical detail that you can see. We've been given $28 million of revenue over the course of our UNLV's lifespan and where we've spent it. And so a big chunk of that is on salary and fringes, as you can see. But we have not spent all the money that we've received there, and that's a self-supporting account. So we continue to, that helps us to develop some of those joint programs. This is a little bit about our GME funding. And you can see that the UMC is the big blue piece of that pie and represents about 63% of all of our expenditures in the GME realm. And then you can see that the slide isn't showing up very well, but the 7% for the VA, so it's about $1.5 million, and we have residents rotate through the VA, as well as Sunrise and a variety of other locations within the community. To the right are all of the programs that we have, and you can see we have 286 residents in these different specialties, and then we have 53 fellows in the specialties in the right column. And we have the planned program expansion. This is where we're working and focusing. This is part of our strategic plan. I don't know if you want to. And rheumatology is missing off of that. And
do you want to check? No,
okay.
Yeah, Mark Hahn for the record. Just, I don't know how, but we started the first rheumatology fellowship program in the state. That should be up there. So we have two fellows in the program, and anyway, with a maximum of four, it's a two-year program.
All right, here's the real test to see if this works. I wanted to talk a little bit more about our clinical faculty. So this is going to be an example of one clinical faculty. So it's a one FTE and how we go about determining how we fund that and what source of funding we use to share the load of the expense that it takes to have the clinical faculty that we have. And so the first thing we look at is the academic endeavors, which, you know, they're going to have students rotating with them in their clinical activities. They're going to have times when they're going to be called in to do committee work to determine what students we're going to offer a position at the school. We're going to have as core faculty members in the residency program. So we determine how much of their work is academic endeavors. So these are some of the examples that we talked about, academic evaluations and committee work and having students and or residents just be with them and they take the time to teach instead of just see patients. And then we take from that and we see, is there an educational assignment? So our academic affairs team may say, hey, we need you to teach this problem-based learning, or have them be part of a clerkship director to ensure that they're getting the education they need as they go through the different clinics. So there's different academic assignments that are provided, and we provide a budget for the academic affairs team to determine who they need to do that work. And then there's some graduate medical education money, and this may come from UMC or some of the support there or from other areas. It's not generally state dollars, but it is another assignment they give to be a program director, and it's specifically time that is required as part of our accreditation to be in the ACGME role as a program director or an APD, assistant or associate program director. And then if there's funded research, obviously that takes away from their one FTE. So then we just kind of come to what is a not so simple math exercise. We take that one and we figure out where all those funding sources go, and then what's left is the revenue that they've got to generate in clinical practice as a physician for UNLV Health. And so then we put that budget there in that self-supporting line. So this is kind of how we figure out what sources of funding we use to support the medical school and all of the faculty that are needed to provide that experience. And what this slide is the audited financial statement of our history of UNLV Health. So you can see the last 4 years, we've had a positive change in net position. As a nonprofit, we call it net position. And our revenues have kind of been pretty stable, but COVID was very impactful, as you can see, and we've kind of been building up from there. So we're I think it's a really good story what's going on with UNLV Health. It's 7 years into it, and a lot of startups, and this was very much similar to a startup, you know, really struggled to make it to 5 years, and we're starting to get stabilized. We still have a lot of recruitment to do. There's still a lot of areas, and I'll let Dr. Khan talk about that if he wants to, but we have a lot of areas that we need to continue to grow to help support our community. But I think this is a really good story, and the financial story that has been told, especially over the last 4 years, is really solid.
All right, so let me just wrap up with a summary. So a couple things. You know, we're really proud of what we're doing. We, as you see, we're cash flow positive. The GME deficits that Mr. Bates showed, just to clarify, those are timing issues. So we have to pay the residents, and then we invoice the hospitals. So those aren't real, true deficits. Tuition, I'm really proud. Our tuition is really between 4 and 5% of our total revenue. I came from an institution where tuition was 57%. So the result of this is that our tuition, as is as are the folks at UNR, we have some of the lowest tuition in the country and resultingly have some of the lowest medical student debt in the country. And we want to keep it that way. Both Dr. Houtman and I this past year kept our tuition increase below what was recommended by ENCHI, recognizing that we want to minimize our student debt. The other thing I just want to make people aware of is that when Dr. Houtman and I talk about GME funding and how the money may come from the hospital, it actually originally comes from the federal government. So Medicare and Medicaid, CMS, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, provide the bulk of the money to the hospitals in two buckets of money that they use to pay the residents. I think that's important. So in summary, for UNLV, we're really proud of where we've come in a short time. We, in 8 years, have had attrition of only one student. On match day, every student has had a job, and we're really happy with that. You saw our GME programs, and we're working. We just submitted an application for the state's first fellowship in hematology medical oncology. We're working with some donors and an outside group to start a residency program in ophthalmology, and we're very excited to hopefully be able to start a program in neurology. Now, these are going to require state funding, and Dr. Houtman and I have been working with elected officials to get state money to support GME because those funded positions by CMS were capped in 1996. As you see, we had a clean audit, which we're really happy with a positive margin. Although we're a new school, our research continues to grow. And, we're really with UNR, we're building out the concept in the state of academic health. So an academic health center is a medical school, the affiliated health science program. So for us, it's nursing and public health and integrated health and behavioral health and public health, working together with a hospital or hospitals. For us, it's UMC. For our friends, it's Renown. And we work together to provide coordinated care, to provide evidence-based care, to provide quality care for our population or for our community. And for Dr. Houtman and I, we see the concept of statewide academic health. They're leading the charge in the north, we're leading the charge in the south, but we're working together to improve the lives of our community. And with that, I thank you for your time and attention. Thank you.
Do we have any questions from either regents here? Okay, I have a few questions. So when we're talking about, I'm involved in all this stuff, so sorry if I'm digging.
Not a problem.
Going in the weeds with you. When we look at this financial structure, right, and it's complicated, convoluted, I'm asking this because there have been questions. And the reason I wanted this drill down was because there have been questions, there has been stuff out there saying, is money for the practice plan being used for other things? So is there a space here that allows the state academic money maybe to, it just seems like it's very nebulous. You've got your academic endeavors plus your academic education assignment plus your GME, funded research, and then you got the clinical. Is there room to move the dollars? Is that why this perception is out there?
It's thank you, Mark Kahn, for the record. Regent Goodman, it's complicated because we could say that 100% of what our faculty do in clinic is teaching, because they always have students or residents. Truth of the matter is we have a fixed amount of state dollars, and we're also generating revenue at the same time. So it's rather arbitrary. When you look at what an academic clinician does, it's arbitrary how much of that is teaching. I could consider all of it teaching. I mean, when I'm seeing patients, I don't do that a lot, but I always have trainees with me, 100% of the time. Is that teaching or is that revenue generation? It gets complicated, right? But what we do is we can account to the dollar for the state dollars to show that that is being used for education. In fact, some of the clinical dollars are also used for education. As with every other medical school that has a practice plan, it's the practice plan that really sustains the efforts. Medical schools lose, I just saw a recent statistic from the AAMC, they spend $1.62 for every dollar they get in research money, right? Tuition doesn't pay for costs either. Philanthropy is nice, but it's not necessarily, it's somewhat fickle. So it's really the clinical enterprise that drives the financial stability of a medical school. So that's where things get complicated. What we don't do is we don't take state money to pay salaries in the practice plan. So if somebody is in the revenue cycle for the practice plan, helping us collect, bill and collect, that money's paid from the practice plan, and the practice plan charges overhead for that. So we're not commingling funds, but we're taking our state funds and allocating them for educational activities. The reason it gets complicated is we all do more education than what we're paid for by the state.
Thank you. Go ahead, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Goodman. So then, based on what you said, if I go back to slide number 3, in that bottom left-hand corner, you've got 187 clinical academic faculty budgeted. So do you really have 187, or are they just budgeted? And is there a gap
there? I think
we
actually are budgeted for more than that, but I'll let Mr. Bates answer.
Ron Bates, for the record, yeah, we have a number of vacancies in clinical positions, and some of those are positions that we haven't filled. Some of those are turnover, but we have 44 active recruitments going on right now. So, yeah, the 187 we do not have.
I thought we had 187 plus that 40.
No, those 40 are
okay,
the 187 budgeted number, yeah.
But we're getting the money from the state for 187. Is that correct?
It is, yes. A short answer is yes. But we get it for the education. I think if I can elaborate on that a little bit, Dr. Khan kind of talked about how we have positions moving around. So we budget to the clinical department what it's going to take to educate. And we allocate that money in the budget for the people that we think are going to be there. Okay. But if there's 10 people in the department that we think are going to be there and it's going to cost X amount of dollars and there's only 5 people in the department, those 5 people have to do what we planned the 10 people to do. So that's where we have to move that money around to pick up the vacant positions, because they're very small. If you look on page 7 of the graph with the clinical faculty, I think what we would like to see is that blue mark be even further down. It's about 33% of our faculty are paid out of the state. And the orange bar is what the practice plan pays. Are you?
Page 7.
You see
academic faculty funding by source.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the money that needs to be spent to educate our students, and the number of faculty we have in there depends on if you as a faculty member get X percent. If you and I both were going to split that 50-50, and I'm not here, then you have to do my work. And so that's how we allocate the money. So we budget it based on how many people we think are going to be here, and then we actually allocate it based on how many people are there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Mark Khan, for the record. Regent, one of the things that gets complicated is when we have state money, that state money for our clinicians doesn't fund a full position, because some of the clinicians earn, money in revenue that helps support their salary. So it's not like another department on campus where if we have a position, that's solely funded by the state. That's why people have fractions of state positions, right? So we tell them what their salary is, and we sort of tell them what, not sort of, we tell them what their responsibilities are, but they can vary over time depending on who's in the department and who's not, if that makes sense. So it's a little different than other other divisions. And I think Mr. Vitone wants to say a word or two.
But wait, before you say something, I just want to clarify, because 187 clinical academic faculty budgeted sounds like it's 187 clinical faculty are budgeted, when in fact only 143 clinical faculty are budgeted. So I'm just saying, like, right. We're talking about faculty budgets. I'm just wondering, so just Chris, go ahead with that, sure. Mr. Vitone.
Sure, Chris Vitone, System CFO. So I would clarify, 187 faculty are budgeted. I think there's vacancies, so there's 143 filled faculty positions. In terms of just the distribution between of those budgets, it doesn't mean 187 are fully funded through the state budgets. No. They're budgeted in total between the self-supporting activity and the state activity. So their positions are split funded, which is what the Dean Kahn and Mr. Bates are explaining. And as they have vacancy, you'll have fractional positions on the state side that may have to be covered more at a higher percentage than initially planned if all positions were filled, because it is partial FTE funding on the state side and on the self-supporting side through the practice plan.
Thank you. But if I may, and this is the kind of stuff I'm talking about, that should have been broken down. Like, it shouldn't have had to be for Regent Del Carlo to ask the question, and there's 44 positions that aren't being funded. This is the kind of stuff I'm talking about. And Dean Kahn, I like you very much, and I'm not trying to come down on you, but this is the kind of stuff that gets all of these people out there talking about how we're not transparent. And so even, I'm sure there's a wonderful explanation for it, and if we saw that breakdown with those half positions, we could actually say, okay, this makes sense. But it's not just two positions that aren't being budgeted for. It's 44. So it's this kind of stuff that I think we just need to do better at moving forward, just so that we can stop all of these rumors that are out there that we aren't being transparent, because we are, and I think you are doing incredible work there. It's just this kind of stuff can't just go. An omission is the same as a lie, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that we need to do better about not having omissions. And I say this with all due respect, sir. Go ahead, Regent Brager.
Do you want to answer anything though before I?
Yeah, just to say, we showed you that our clinical faculty are only supported in part by state funds. That's this graph right here. And we showed you that most of the way we fund our clinicians are through self-supporting dollars. We also can show you as a complete budget what percentage is state-funded and what percentage is self-supporting. I'll try to be as transparent as I can, but honestly, we thought that was reasonably transparent. Thank you.
Go ahead, Regent Brager. Okay.
Susan Brager for the record. I'm looking at the GME funding by source page. When you put something down like plan, program, expansion, and long term, I guess what would that take? Because we already know we don't have enough anesthesiologists, let alone in the state. And so that to me seems more of a, I could be wrong, I'm not a doctor, but you cannot do surgeries without anesthesiologists. So to me, ophthalmology is nice, but I feel like in every corner there's a eye doctor every time I drive around. How do you prioritize these? And is that in your funding source is it there somewhere for future that you're building on it? Or does it come about because I'm gonna add this, 1% in gifts and endowments, is that normal? I didn't get to ask you, NR, but yours was easy to find on this document. Is that something that would help with something like that? If you went out to the people to be here that have those multi millions of dollars and they might need a surgery, the anesthesiology department would be very important.
Thank you, Dr. Brager. Ms. Brager, Regent Brager, that's a good question. Mark Kahn for the record. So, anesthesiologists are desperately needed in our community. The issue is who's going to fund this, and that's why we've asked the state, both Dr. Hauptmann and I, for additional resources to grow GME. Anesthesia would be very high on our list. The plan program expansion really depends on opportunity. So we were able to get a state grant 2 years ago to help fund a pilot program to put together an application for hematology medical oncology, which we submitted about a month ago. We're also working with a comprehensive cancer center to try to bring them here with us to work together to provide that high level of cancer care. So again, that was an opportunity. For ophthalmology, this really is philanthropically supported. Okay. There's an outside group that is raising money as part of a not-for-profit. They want to start an ophthalmology program with us. Former Emeritus Regent Dubrava is part of this process. So this is an opportunity that we don't want to let go. And neurology, we have expertise in the university in brain health. The community needs better stroke care. We've been talking to the Lou Ruvo Center about a potential combined residency program. So that represents an opportunity as well. To cut to the chase, to build a GME program requires about $120,000 roughly per resident. And you have to remember, the programs aren't 1 year in length. So if we had two residents in a three-year program, we need six times that amount. And those dollars, again, for many programs, come from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. But those positions were funded in 1990, or were capped in 1997 by a law enacted in 1996. We're not very optimistic that there's going to be federal support for GME expansion. As part of the Affordable Care Act, the feds did expand 1,000 positions over 5 years for the entire country. And we got a little under two positions as part of that process, but that's small. Dr. Hauptmann and I have been working with elected officials to try to get state funding. We think that's the solution.
So then to follow up on that, you wouldn't move, because you can't do a lot of these things without the anesthesiologist in the room, and I don't want to beat this up, but that seems like something that really the state needs to identify along with you and really working with our federal components, because it's such a shortage.
I completely agree. And again, if we get state funding, that will be an absolutely top priority. Dr. Hauptmann and I have talked about a 5-5-5 plan. We've asked the state, if you give each public medical school $5 million each year of the biennium, we'll each stand up five new programs in 5 years. For us, anesthesiologists is on the list. Dr. Hauptmann could comment on what's on his list, but yeah.
No, I'm good. Yeah. No, I think that he's comfortable. Okay, if we could continue to get, or I hope all of us get reports on that.
Absolutely.
I just think that we don't want people to continue to leave our state just because they can't have a surgery, and we are the medical schools, but do we have a good program with our hospitals that the other, I mean, I know we have UMC, but all hospitals are having this need, and we are the two major medical schools, I think I would call it major, that have majority of the funding throughout the state. So just something futuristically that I think needs to be high up on our list so that people don't have to wait, you know, weeks and months, and if it's not, you know, I mean, some sort of an emergency.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Regent. Thank you, Regent Brager. You know, I know Regent Brager has a hard stop at 3:00. I have so many questions still. I do see that, for instance, grants and contracts, UNLV is at 3%, UNR is at 28%. Is that just because of the history of the school? Is, you know, just that disparity? I'd love you to just...
Yeah, Mark Kahn, for the record. I think Yes, we're a new school, so we're growing our research base, but it's still relatively small compared to what UNR has. And we, you know, I think we got, what, about $7 or $8 million in externally funded grants since the summer. So we're working hard, but, you know, we're new, so we have a lot of growing to do.
And is your foundation the Academic Research Foundation, or is your foundation UNLV Foundation? Who's out there raising the money for you?
Yeah, so for research, we're talking about external funding. So these are investigators that write grants to get funding from agencies such as HRSA or NIH. For the philanthropy that we do, it's not specifically related to research. That comes through the foundation. And we've actually had some big gifts this year as well for that.
And that's through the UNLV Foundation?
UNLV Foundation,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Did you have a question, Regent Del Carlo? I have just one more. Okay, and then quickly, I just wanted to ask, the $84 million, you know, we see this increase this year. Is that truly attributed to the fact that, you know, COVID's gone and you're able to see that many more patients? Because it's a large number. It's nearly $20 million. So is that the reason why?
I think it's a couple things. I think that the folks in the practice plan have negotiated some better contracts with some of the third-party payers. I think that as we grow, people recognize our reputation. We provide some services not otherwise available in the community. I think we employ 4 of the 5 oncologic surgeons in the entire town, for example. I think some of that is also the Medicaid uplift. So you heard Dr. Hauptmann talk about the Medicaid uplift program. We're part of that as well, and that's been very helpful. That's an effort by Medicaid for I believe there's only 4 entities. Us, UNR, Renown, and UMC are eligible to try to increase our Medicaid payments because of the number of Medicaid patients we actually care for. It's that combination.
Yes, wonderful. And then just quickly, I think it'd be remiss if we didn't mention that, you know, when we look at that GME funding by source, you know, Renown is just this incredible, you know, it's Reno, and 68% is being spent, you know, at $9.8 million, and we'd be remiss if we didn't notice that UMC, you know, has such a great investment in our school here with a 63% funding by source, and so it's just very significant. And you know, I just want to say on the record that it's vital that we continue to foster and cultivate this relationship that we have with UMC.
Hear, hear. Second, again, that relationship is sacrosanct, and we're here to care for everybody with UMC, and that relationship is absolutely mission critical.
Thank you. Go ahead, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Goodman. Just a question. On page 5, you show, let me get back to page 5. I'm going to have to put my glasses on for that one. Okay. Nope, wrong page. Okay, it shows the practice plan at $83,166,445. And then if you go to page 12, it's $83 million, but it's not the same figure, and I just wondered why. It's $83 million, but it's not exactly the same figure. Shouldn't it be? For 2024?
I'm sorry, my page 12 is a summary statement.
Okay, my page 12 is, it's UNL.
Audited financial.
Audited financial history. So right. 2024 shows $83,718,454. Shouldn't that be the same figure?
Ron Bates, for the record, it absolutely should be. We may have put that number in before the audit number was final, and
okay.
I had an estimate, and I probably didn't catch that on the update.
See, we do read this stuff.
Yes, yes.
And then
we're off by $600.
Same number.
Well,
yes.
But you're right. Good
it
pick
should
up.
Be the same.
Good pickup.
Okay, and then I would say on that back to page 5 again, that was a summary, and I would like in future meetings, Madam Chair, I don't know if this is new business, it shouldn't be, but that's a summary. It really would help us to have budget to actual for that.
Sure. If we're going to be open and transparent, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, and then one final thing. I really would like to, so that we can start comparing basically month to month, I would like to see kind of a monthly statement. My nonprofit, we do a P&L, you know, and, yeah. And my board, when they want to say, I mean, they can look and see, you know, what I paid for parking, you know, at a at yeah. an event. I would really love, and you know, it, even if it's just us meeting as a committee sure. or just me as the chair, I'm not sure how we figure that out, but I'd really like for us to start drilling down and showing that so that we can, I just want to squelch these rumors that are out there. I want us to really move forward and implement some of these things so that we can say, I don't know what you're talking about because here it is right here. Okay, yeah. So thank you.
Thank you. We can provide that both for the practice plan and the school as a whole.
Yes, both. Please.
Okay, we do that anyway. We can do that.
Yes, please. I know you already have it, so it's not extra work, so I'd yeah. greatly appreciate it. Okay, do we have any more questions? Anyone? Okay, great. All right, moving on, we will go to item number 6, handbook revision, ENSHE AIDS guidelines. UNR Student Health Center Medical Director Dr. Cheryl Hug English will present for approval a revision to board policy Title IV, Chapter 1, Section 21, eliminating the ENSHE AIDS guidelines. Thank you so much. Is she here?
So, Chair, she's actually in Reno, and so just want to make sure that we are still connected to Reno by sound.
Can you hear me?
That's Doug. Dr. Hug English. So for the record, again, Patty Charlton tossing it over to Dr. Hug English from UNR. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Chancellor, members of the committee, for the record, Cheryl Hug English, Medical Director of the Student Health Center from University of Nevada, Reno. And I'm going to assume that you're all there. I just see this big blue screen. So please interrupt me if I'm not coming through. I am here today to address the HIV/AIDS policy in Title IV, Chapter 1, Section 21 of the handbook. This policy dates back to 2004 and was designed to provide guidance to ENSHE for HIV and AIDS-related issues. However, much has changed over the last 20 years. 20 years ago, there was still a lot of stigma around the diagnosis of AIDS. Today, we have over 1.2 million people in the United States living with HIV, and we have both preventative medications and really good treatment options for this disease. The current guidance and approach from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has shifted focus to education, awareness, prevention, and treatment. Years ago, the diagnosis of AIDS was shrouded in secrecy, but today there is a recommendation for everyone to get tested and to know their HIV status. Leaving this language in the handbook singles out the diagnosis of AIDS, one of many infectious diseases, and inadvertently may lead to further stigma. AIDS diagnosis is already protected under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and Title II of the Americans with Disability Act of 1990, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of disability, which would include individuals who are living with HIV or AIDS. Our ENSHE institutions already comply with the American Disabilities Act by creating and promoting access, reasonable accommodations, and inclusions of individuals under these acts. Again, this would include individuals with HIV or AIDS diagnosis. For all of the above reasons, this policy no longer seems necessary or relevant, and I would make a recommendation that it be removed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your presentation. Do we have any questions?
I have one question.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair, and to you, Dr. English, Hug English. How'd you find this policy? I mean, were you just happen to be going through the manual? Because I've said all along we need to go through our code. It's probably been a long, long, long time since we have. I think Chancellor's got her hand up.
Yes, so thank you for the record, Patty Charlton. Thank you so much, Regent Del Carlo, for that question. This is actually a carryover of a new business item from Regents that came forward. And as someone who has provided a great deal of guidance to the board over the years, I asked Dr. Hug English to review this policy with myself and Vice Chancellor Archer and provide some recommendation. But thank you, and you're absolutely right. There's probably many more of these that we need to go through. So we're taking them one at a time. But I did want to just acknowledge Dr. Hug English and all the work that she has done on behalf of the system. I know she was a stellar force during COVID and providing amazing guidance to not just the system, but to every institution as well.
Thank you. Do we have a motion?
Madam Chair.
Oh, yes. Regent Boylan.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair. And this is through you to Chancellor Charlton. She just mentioned that the regents had brought this forward. When was this brought forward and by which regents, Chancellor?
Thank you. For the record, Patty Charlton, I believe it was brought forward in perhaps 2022 or 2023 by now Chair Carvalho and perhaps even a former regent.
Thank you, Chancellor. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Regent Boylan.
I would like to make a motion.
Yes, go ahead.
For approval to a revision of the board policy, Title 4, Chapter 1, Section 21, eliminating the NGAIDS guideline.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second that.
Regent Perkins here, second?
Yes. Go ahead, Regent Perkins. She has a second. Oh, you wanted a second?
Oh, I was just seconding.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Thank you. We have the motion from Regent Del Carlo and the second from Regent Brager already, but thank you. Moving forward, let's call for the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Anyone opposed? Okay, motion passes. Thank you very much. We'll move on to item number 7, nursing math pathways.
Chair Goodman, I'm yes. Sorry.
Yes.
This is Amy Carvalho. I texted you to try to get a chance to comment, but I know you're busy running the meeting, and I've got a blue screen in front of me, so I don't know who sees what on here.
Okay.
But may I have just a moment?
Of course. Go ahead, Regent.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I did want to say that I did bring this forward. I saw this in our handbook. This policy struck me as something that as Dr. Hug English had said before was addressed a time from our system when AIDS was thought of as something very different than it is now. I think we've come a long way in our culture in understanding this diagnosis and what this means. And when I saw it, I thought it was important to bring it forward. You know, our policies are really living, dynamic documents, and so I thought it was important to bring this forward at this time. So I do really appreciate the committee's approval of this, and also Dr. Hug English's comments regarding the history of it and how it's important to move forward from that. So I appreciate the time, and thank you.
Thank you so much, Regent Carvalho. All right, we're going to move forward to the nursing math pathways, item number 7. Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Daniel Archer, will provide information on the math pathways work underway with NSHE's system-wide Launch Years Initiative Task Force. Current Bachelor of Science in Nursing math pathways at the universities, preliminary findings from a system-wide academic discipline survey, data center sample math pathways, and next steps for this system. I'm very excited about this item, Daniel. This is very exciting. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Daniel Archer for the record. So I'm going to talk about math pathways and its connection to nursing here. So I just want to start out by giving you a snapshot of the things we're going to jump into today. So we're going to talk about the Launch Years Task Force. We're going to talk about what that is and who all is involved in it. We're going to provide kind of a macro and micro overview of math pathways. And really look at it kind of the 100,000-foot level. We're looking at it through a system-wide lens, but also looking at it on the ground at the programmatic level and looking at it specifically through a nursing lens here. And we're focusing on nursing because obviously it falls into the health sciences domain, so it's germane, obviously, to this committee. All seven of our institutions have nursing programs. Obviously, there's high student demand. There's high workforce demand. So there'll be a focus on nursing today. We're also going to touch on some surveying that we've done within the Math Pathways Project. And then in the end, we want to kind of put on our pragmatic hat and share what a finished work product may look like here. So we want to provide a really clear picture for how we ultimately envision this working in practice when we get to the finish line. So in terms of background on LaunchEar's initiative here, so we touched on this at the full board meeting back in March. So just as a reminder, we were awarded a technical assistance grant to work with the Dana Center at the University of Texas at Austin, which is really the leading entity in the country when it comes to shaping math reform. So I want to clarify that this does not cost INCHI anything. In return, we are getting technical assistance from the leading entity, again, in the country that's helped other states and systems do this work here. So we are working kind of under the auspices of the Dana Center and a proven model that's been applied, again, in multiple states and systems across the country here. So we are working with the Dana Center. When I say we, I'm referring to a math task force. We have math faculty from every INCHI institution, and this is being facilitated by Renee Davis and Dave Singleton at INCHI, so I appreciate everyone who's participating in that particular space here. The main focus, though, was on math pathways, and it's really based on having common general education course requirements for specific disciplines. So the states and systems that have done this, they have all of their elementary education majors taking the same general education math requirement. They have all of the political science majors in the system taking the same general education math requirement. They have the same general education math requirement for nursing majors, and the list goes on and on and on for all programs, all undergraduate programs throughout the system, and obviously that's what we're working toward here. And a big part of this work really centers around one core question, and that is what math skills are most critical for a student to be successful in an academic and career field here? What's going to put them in a position to be successful in that more advanced coursework? And ultimately, what's going to put them in a position, again, to be successful in their career. And so Math Pathways is really like having a customized toolbox here. Each student is given the tools they need to be successful here. And really, the right tools make all the difference in the world here. Because obviously, when we're talking about tools and getting into careers, elementary education majors are going to need specific math tools to be successful. They're going to have to learn a lot about assessment and measurement. Business majors are going to have to learn about modeling and predictive analytics and forecasting. The tools that a political science major are going to be a little different. They're going to learn about data science and how that applies to working in campaigns and working in political administrations and things like that. So building on this, our Math Task Force designed a survey with various math skills listed, and we asked the respondents, which are academic department chairs throughout our system, to check all of the math skills that are critical for a student to be successful. So we sent that out. We're still collecting that data, and I'll revisit that here in a moment. But in terms of looking at this specifically through a nursing lens, so we're talking about the Bachelor of Science in Nursing, and we're looking at the Gateway, which is also known as the General Education Math Requirement here. We're looking at the Gateway course requirements here. You'll notice they're different on each university's campus here. You'll see that UNLV, it's college algebra. At UNR, it's pre-calculus. At NSU, it's fundamentals of math. So we're just looking at the universities here. So obviously the goal of Math Pathways, as I previously alluded, is to have alignment. So we want to build that continuity, obviously, in this space here. I think there's some other differences that are worth pointing out here. When you talk about chemistry, there's some differences in the chemistry courses there. And then also with statistics. And statistics, I think something that's important to point out is that on multiple INCHI campuses, you have to complete college algebra or pre-calculus before you can enroll in a statistics course here. And it's very important to note that the American Mathematical Association and the Dana Center and other national math entities do not endorse this practice. They've done back mapping and went back and looked at what algebra skills are needed to be successful in a introductory college stat course. They've done back mapping, and it really boils down to skills that one acquires in a Algebra 1 high school course, which is something that you take in 8th or 9th grade. So what you've seen is you've seen a lot of states and systems throughout the country remove that prerequisite requirement. So when we talk about math pathways more broadly, you have the discipline alignment, which I talked about before, with making sure that the disciplines have the same general education math requirement, having that commonality. So you have that piece. But there's also some things that kind of fall in the math domain. There's some traditional math practices and revisiting those and hopefully taking a more contemporary kind of student-friendly approach. So you have a lot of moving parts and multiple layers here. This seems really simple on the surface, but there's a lot of folks involved in these conversations and decisions. So the task force, again, as I mentioned, has done some surveying here. They've just started to analyze the survey results, and we're looking at the preliminary results. The department chairs from different disciplines have expressed preferences for different skills here, which was fully expected here, but some preferred statistic skills. Some preferred algebra and pre-calculus. Some preferred both of those. Some preferred quantitative reasoning, which is more of a practical math that students can use in real-life situations. A lot of the Bachelor of Arts majors, Bachelor of Fine Arts majors take that course. So nursing in particular indicated a preference for statistics, so that's worth noting here. In the end, though, a finished work product would look something like this here. You would have each math pathway course in three separate columns. So you'll see the three courses, quantitative reasoning being the first, pre-calculus being the second course, and then statistics being the third course. And under each respective course, you would see a list of the majors that require that specific course here. So pretty simple concept. You know, all under this model here, and this is something from another state, all criminal justice majors would take statistics, and that would apply at every institution in the system. All nursing majors would take stats. All psychology majors would take stats. All philosophy majors would take quantitative reasoning and so on and so forth. So I think this is a great resource for students, for academic advisors, for high school counselors. It simplifies things. It organizes things. It provides clarity. It provides system-wide continuity. It improves transfer because we're all on the same page and we're all sort of marching in the same direction. In terms of next steps here, the Math Task Force is examining the data from the surveys, and the survey is still open here. We've kind of nudged one institution that didn't have as high a participation rate as we would like, so we want to make sure that we have feedback from everybody. So we're still working on collecting some feedback here, but the data from the surveys will be used to help facilitate conversations with department chairs across the state here. And based on my experience and my experience only, I would envision that some of these will probably be easier than others. I was in another system where we just did this work, and we had the social science discipline come in one meeting we agreed to statistics, and it was over. It was really quick, and there were people even engaged in those conversations that were really critical of a lot of system work that were really supportive of this. So that's just one example, but there were other disciplines where we had to meet multiple times and it required a lot more perseverance and patience. We got there, and I think I would foresee that probably happening here as well. So it's also worth noting, again, we go back to nursing here. We do have a really good resource, again, from the Dana Center. They wrote a paper on how they worked with nursing faculty on math pathways in the Texas higher education system. So I think that'll be helpful for us to see how another system really handled the exact same situation. It doesn't mean we have to do the exact same thing, but I think it's helpful to see how another system handled it. So with that, that wraps up my presentation. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
It's a wonderful presentation. Thank you. And I listen, if we can follow best practices of somebody else, let's do it. So I just think it's wonderful, and I love that it's not costing us anything, and it's simplifying it for not only our students, but for those people who are trying to articulate what the pathways are. I just think that that's a great benefit, too. So thank you. Regent Del Carlo?
Thank you, Chair Goodman. This is exciting. I like this for a systemness. And I know you touched on timeline. So you've got a committee working this. You're still collecting data.
Right.
So at that point, does this then at some point come to the ARSA committee?
Yeah. So what would happen from here is the Dana Center has sort of progress updates, and we have to provide kind of an update on some next steps after the surveying. That's due in February, and so I think that will kind of outline our plan going forward in terms of meeting with the disciplines. I'm happy to share that with you all as a board or you as the chair.
Okay.
But then we'll kind of outline the timing. I imagine we'll hopefully start having those disciplines meet in the spring. Summer probably will be a no-go because faculty will largely be unavailable at that time. So we resume in the fall and hopefully wrap this up next year.
Okay, because I know when we went to the co-requisite from the remedial, I think it we was it a two-year implementation once we made the decision to do it?
Right, and that's there would have to be some pretty significant changes. As an example, statistics is not a general education pathway, so our math departments would have to certainly kind of change some of their offerings and have more statistics offerings. So there would be a phase-in process, and we would certainly be outlining what that would look like, too, down the road.
So it sounds like there's still considerable work ahead.
There is, yeah.
This is a great concept and idea moving forward. So thank you for bringing this. Thank you, Chair Goodman.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any comments? Okay. All right, thank you so much. We will move on to item number 8, new business. Does anyone have any items for new business? Okay. Seeing none, we will move on to item 9, public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is none at this time.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
None at this time.
Thank you. Here in Las Vegas, any public comment? No. And SCS, is there any public comment on the phone? Okay, well, thank you all, and apologies for the technical difficulties. Our meeting is adjourned.